And I'm also going to try to talk a little bit about localization. But let me be clear about one thing. Everything I talk about today is at zero temperature. So it's zero temperature. That's it. And
they're used to that.
Yeah. And it's going to be. We are going to talk about quantum phase transitions, though. We're going to think about a system in an external magnetic field, which is transverse. So we're going to worry about the properties of that system as we change the field. And this is the reason we do this. Although is because in quantum algorithms, as I'll try to explain, this can be of interest. And these are my collaborators. That's Mr. Goldstone of the Goldstone bosons, who is still around and really fantastic collaborator. And the others, well, I should say who my collaborators are. This is my student, David Gossett, my collaborator, Sam Gutman. This was a former nuclear physics postdoc at MIT, and that's Peter Shor of the Shor factoring algorithm. So as a prelude to this, I would like to talk about unstructured search, random cost functions, and I'm going to give you rigorous results, and I'm going to see, does this have anything to do with Anderson localization? Okay? So I want to tell you what we're going to try to do here is I'm going to try to use ideas from information theory to gain information about physical systems. So let's see if we can do that. So I want to consider a problem. And the problem, we're interested in computer science here. And when I talk about computer science, I'm interested in algorithms for solving problems. I'm not really interested in the answer to the problem. I'm only interested in the algorithm that finds the answer. Okay? So here we have, I want you to think of a cost function, h of z. And z is a bit string, z1 through zn. It's conventional in quantum computing to label to diagonalize everything in the z basis. And this cost function has the property that at some value, there are 2 to the n values here for this bit string. And at one of those values, which I call w, the winner, this cost function is 0. And all other values, it's larger than, the cost function is larger than 0. And the computational task is to find the place where the cost function is minimum. Now, for those, I don't know, this is really not a, this looks to me like a physics audience more than a computer science audience. So let me say something. This problem, if you don't know anything about the cost function, you cannot solve. Let me also adopt my notation. I'm going to call capital N as 2 to the little n. So capital N is very big and little n is not so big. So there are capital N values for the inputs. And there is no algorithm, if you don't know anything about this function, which can find the winner, I call it, that the place where it's minimum, with less than of order capital N queries. Does that make sense? You have to, if the function has no structure. So this is just in general, but if the function has structure, well then maybe it's different. Now, well, I want to turn this into a quantum problem. And so the way we're going to turn it into a quantum problem is we're going to imagine we have a Hilbert space. And the Hilbert space has dimension capital N, which is 2 to the n. And a basis for the Hilbert space are these spins when we think a 0 is a spin up and a down is a spin 1. So there's a Hilbert space of dimension 2 to the n. And we could have a Hamiltonian, which is diagonal in the z basis. And instead of looking for the minimum of the cost function, we're going to want to find the ground state of this Hamiltonian. But since it's diagonal, there's no difference between these two problems. Is that okay? Now, we're going to have it. Now, you are an algorithm designer. And an algorithm designer is a person who can build a Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian the algorithm designer is going to build is going to have that problem Hamiltonian as a piece of it with a coefficient which is time dependent and a driver Hamiltonian. So the algorithm designer is going to try to add to this Hamiltonian something which allows the which is going to make the quantum system evolve. And this quantum system is going to evolve for time according to the Schrodinger equation. Everything evolves according to the Schrodinger equation, and the algorithm designer picks an initial time, and then the quantum system evolves for time t. So the vision here of a quantum computer is, a quantum computer is a Hamiltonian control device. The algorithm designer designs the Hamiltonian, controls it, picks the initial state, decides how long the system evolves for, and then makes a measurement after time t, which is supposed to contain the answer. So in this case, if the algorithm designer at time t, if the wave function at time t has big overlap with this quantum state, a measurement of this would produce w, and it would be a successful algorithm. Does that make sense? Please ask me questions if I'm not making sense. So I'm taking what I call a Hamiltonian approach to quantum algorithms. Usually, you see computer scientists think of computers as things that go tick, 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 tick. So then they think of quantum algorithms as sequences of unitary transformations which ratchet the system. But here, we're going to think of a quantum algorithm as something designed by a Hamiltonian, which is controlled by a Hamiltonian, and it evolves in continuous time. Okay?
Where do you separate the Hamiltonian? Why do you have two parts?
Well, I mean, I want to find the ground state of HP. I don't know what, this seems like a very natural decomposition. If I want to find the ground state of HP, I'm going to allow you to add anything you want to it to control the evolution. I have to have the HP in there some way, yeah.
So how do you start your evolution?
That's up to you. That's up to the algorithm designer. The algorithm designer picks the initial state. The algorithm designer picks the initial state in the Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. I haven't said what the algorithm designer is going to do. I'm going to prove that this problem can't be solved. Well, I'm not going to prove it. I'm going to assert it. So the simplest case is called the Grover problem, unstructured search. The Grover problem, the cost function, is zero on one particular bit string, and it's one on all others. So this is called unstructured search because you're looking for one out of capital N things, and there's no information in the cost function because the cost function is dead flat except at one point. Now, some of you may have heard that this problem can be solved in a quantum computer in time n to the 1/2. That's one of the big results in quantum computing, is that unstructured search can be solved with a square root speed up on a quantum computer. But if we think of it in this continuous time setting, so success means psi of t equals w for all w, it was shown by me and Sam Gutman in 1998 that there is no quantum algorithm that can do this in this continuous time setting unless the time is bigger than n to the 1/2. Now, in a way, so this is from information theory, because we have a problem, and we prove the problem can't be solved in a time less than t to the 1/2, and this is going to turn into a linear algebra result now. Okay? So do you understand what I mean by an information theoretic result? What I mean is, if I tell you you want to search for one thing out of capital N, then the classical information theoretic result is you cannot do that in time less than of order N. This is a quantum information theoretic result that says the time has to be bigger than n to the 1/2. So the proof techniques here don't look anything like linear algebra. So now what I want to discuss is something else, which I call a scrambled cost function. So I want to start with a Hamiltonian. So now I'm going to introduce randomness, because in a way the Grover problem has no randomness, because it just has one winner and it's flat. So I want to start with a Hamiltonian, H of z, which may be structured, and it has a minimum at z equals 0. So by structured, I mean that an example of a structured cost function is z1 plus z2 plus zn. That's very easy to minimize, but it may be structured. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to scramble it. So I'm going to define a new cost function, h pi of z, by I'm going to let pi be a permutation of 0 to n, to n minus 1, or 1 to n, if you wish, or 0. These numbers, I guess, go from, so 0 is the first one, and then the next n minus 1 of them have the non-zero value. So let pi be a permutation of this string. And then I'm going to let h pi of z be h of pi inverse of z. So what does that mean is that I have a cost function defined on bit strings. And now I'm going to totally scramble it. I'm going to take the value on each site, I'm going to throw it somewhere else. You can think of this, if you wish, because we're going to talk about this more, you can think of this, these bits as sitting on a hypercube. So they sit on a hypercube, and at every site there's a cost function. And now I now scramble it, so I just put down the cost function in a different way. So when you scramble it, if you pick a permutation, all structure is gone in H pi, it's scrambled. If I pick a random permutation, because I've just reassigned the energies in a random way. Now, if you evolve with this Hamiltonian, h of t is hd of t plus some constant hp of pi, and now I'm gonna, my cost function now is this sum. It's the sum over all strings I call it the problem Hamiltonian. The thing I want to minimize is this. And if you evolve for time t for some pi independent of the starting state to h psi pi of t, then success, pi of zero is the new winner. And so you have success if your evolved state has big overlap with the winner. So I say if this amplitude squared is bigger than b, you have success. But if this occurs for a set of epsilon n factorial of the permutations, then t has to be bigger than essentially n to the 1/2. So what we're saying is, again, this is an information theoretic proof. We're proving that this, if you have a random cost function, so you have, it's essentially a random cost function. If it's completely random and you want to find the minimum, what we're proving is that no quantum algorithm can solve that problem in time less than n to the 1/2. Now that is now gonna...
Quick question?
Yeah.
I'm confused why that Hamiltonian you've written down encompasses all possible quantum algorithms.
Yeah, that would be a little harder for me to explain. It does, because since I had essentially, it's because you don't like the fact that I put the HP in there with the linear term.
Yeah, it means or this.
Well, let me just give it to you more generally. I let H driver be anything. So if H driver is anything, I can make sort of almost any unitary. And a general quantum algorithm is just a sequence of unitary transformations. So instead of viewing it as you design a sequence of unitary transformations, I say you have a Hamiltonian that's on, which is affecting the unitary transformation. So I'm just doing this in a Hamiltonian language, but it is quite general. So I better move along. So where was I on this? So this means that if you have a random cost function, a quantum computer cannot find the minimum in time t less than n to the 1/2. Now we're going to apply it to the adiabatic theorem and get a linear algebra result about gaps. And this is, and then I'm going to talk about Anderson localization, but I want to be careful here because this conclusion I'm going to draw has to do with completely random cost functions and not structured cost functions such as 3-sat. But I'll try to talk more about what that means. The reason I'm saying some of these things is because Boris Alschul has been writing a lot of papers lately discussing the relationship between adiabatic algorithms and Anderson localization. So I want to establish a few facts before I discuss what Boris says. Okay? So let me tell you what the adiabatic algorithm is for solving problems. The adiabatic algorithm is designed for classical combinatorial optimization problems. A combinatorial optimization problem is essentially a problem where you're asked to find the minimum of a cost function, but that cost function is not a random cost function necessarily, not necessarily, but in the case of interest, it's not a random function. But it's a function that has structure, because it might be associated with a problem such as 2-sat or 3-sat. Does that mean anything to you people? People know what 2-sat and 3-sat is? You don't, should I tell you what that is? Let me just tell you what that is. So 2-sat is, I'll tell you what that is so we have a little common ground here. That was the wrong one. I want this one, right? And I want that one. So let me tell you what 2-sat is, or 3-sat. So this is the problem. I have bit strings which are n long, z1 through zn. And now I'm going to give you a set of constraints on the bits. So it's called a clause. So a clause takes a subset of the bits. Like it might take bits 1 and 22 and 77. I take those three bits. Those three bits can have 8 values. 010, dot, 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 to 111. And in the case of, let's say, if I want to actually call it 3SAT, there's 3 bits here. That's what the 3 means. And the clause says that these 8 assignments of those 3 bits, of those 8 assignments, 7 we're going to call true, and 1 we're going to call false. Or 7 we're going to give an energy 0 to, and 1 of them we're going to give an energy 1 to, if we want to think of it as cost function minimization. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a list of these constraints. So I'm going to say to you, I have n bits, and I have, let's say n is 1,000, and I'm going to give you 2,000 constraints. So I'm going to tell, or clauses, I give you 2,000 triples, and each one of them I tell you what's not allowed. And the computational task is to determine if there is or if there is not one, at least one assignment of the bits which satisfies all the constraints. In other words, the problem is it unfrustrated or is it frustrated classically? That problem for 3SAT has been proven to be what's called NP complete. I'm not going to say what NP is, but let me just tell you, it is NP complete. And what that means that if you could solve that problem, you could solve zillions of other problems in the same complexity class NP. And it is widely believed by computer scientists that there is no classical algorithm that can solve this problem in time substantially less than 2 to the n. There is, of course, an algorithm for solving this problem in time 2 to the n. It is, look, consider every conceivable assignment. And the best, and it is generally believed that there is no algorithm that can do much better than this. This is the one I just showed you is called 3SAT. SAT means satisfiability. You want to satisfy the clauses. So it's kind of interesting here because this looks like something you'd see in many body physics, but this is a definite computer science problem. Okay? One way that you could formulate this problem is to say, I'm going to define a cost function. And the cost function, it looks at every clause, and it assigns a 1 if the clause says this is unsatisfied, and it assigns a 0 if it's satisfied. And if you define, maybe I do this on the next page. No, I didn't. Okay, because also let me explain this on the board. So then, if you define a cost function H, which is the sum over the clauses of clause cost functions, then if you could find the minimum of that function, you would know whether or not you had a an instance which was satisfiable. Because if the minimum was 0, then there would be an assignment of the bits which satisfied all the clauses. And if the minimum is not 0, then you know that it's not satisfiable. So the solving this problem, this satisfiability problem, is equivalent to minimizing a function, which is a local function. That's what I mean by local. I don't mean spatially local. I just mean that each bit is only involved with a couple of other bits in each clause.
Is 2SAT NP?
No, 2SAT's in P, which means that there's a polynomial time. Well, this is very interesting. I mean, 2SAT, which means that the clauses only have 2 bits, there is a polynomial time algorithm for determining whether or not it has a satisfying assignment. But I could ask a different question in 2SAT. I could give you an instance of 2SAT, and I say, find the configuration that minimizes the number of violations. If it's 0, you can determine it, because there's a polynomial time algorithm. But if I just say, find the configuration that minimizes the number of violations, that's called NP-hard. So some of these things are, they're... except it's not random. I mean, also, I should be saying another thing here. Well, yeah, but I should say another thing. When we talk about NP completeness, we're really I have to be careful when I talk about this, because NP completeness is about worst case. When you say I want it, it's worst case. Because you might have an algorithm that works very well for one of these problems, but you don't have an algorithm that works in worst case. So there are big issues here about random ensembles versus worst case. But NP completeness is only a discussion of worst case. Because if you start to talk to computer scientists about ensembles, it's going to be a very long day. Okay? So they talk about only worst case. So anyway, the adiabatic algorithms are designed for, so this is a classical combinatorial optimization problem. I don't know what combinatorial means, but that's what this is. Okay? So I guess combinations of things come into it or something, I don't know. But it's an optimization problem. And the way we're going to attack it is this. We're going to approach it using the adiabatic theorem. The adiabatic theorem says, I've got to do this more quickly. The adiabatic theorem says if you have a quantum system and it's a ground state, and then the Hamiltonian evolves slowly, that the state, which is evolving according to the Schrodinger equation, will stay close to the instantaneous eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so that it says it's that's what it says. We'll talk about how fast in a moment, but how slowly you have to go in a moment. But that's the content of the adiabatic theorem, right? If you take a quantum system, you put it in the ground state, and you slowly change the Hamiltonian, the system gets dragged along, staying in the instantaneous ground state. So the idea for the adiabatic algorithm is this. We have a problem Hamiltonian. We want to find its ground state. This Hamiltonian is very easy to construct. Just like this cost function is very easy to construct. See, if I give you this cost function here on a classical computer, it's extremely easy to write code for it. It's very hard to find its minimum. So it's easy. You have the cost function on your computer, but it's very hard to find its minimum. So the idea of the adiabatic theorem is we translate this cost function into the problem Hamiltonian I said before. And then we want to find its ground state. So the idea is, if you start a quantum system you build a Hamiltonian whose ground state you know. You put the quantum system in that ground state, and then you morph the Hamiltonian into the problem Hamiltonian. And if you go slowly enough, you'll end up in the ground state of the problem that you wish to solve. Okay? So again, you start with a Hamiltonian you know, whose ground state you know. You slowly turn it into the problem Hamiltonian. And we do that here by picking a beginning Hamiltonian, an interpolating parameter S, which goes from 0 to 1. When S is 0, I have only beginning Hamiltonian. When S is 1, I have problem. If H is a beginning Hamiltonian, HP is an instance-dependent problem Hamiltonian. The ground state of HP encodes the solution. And what we're going to do is we're going to use this Hamiltonian, H of S, to define a Hamiltonian which depends on time by using H of little t over big T. So big T is going to be the long time. And by making big T big, you're taking this Hamiltonian here, which is defined from 0 to 1, and you're stretching it out between 0 and capital T. And that's what's making it slowly changing. That's what allows you to apply the adiabatic theorem. Yeah?
Is it clear that this Lee-Hamiltonian protocol is best?
No. No, it's not clear that this is best. Just an example. Okay? Easy to write down. Okay?
Because HP depends on HP.
I'm sorry?
Because HP depends on HP.
HP? HB? Yeah. No, HB is independent. To be more specific, the thing we usually think about is this. HP is defined in the Z basis between couplings of spins in the Z basis. And for HB, we take a magnetic field in the X direction. Uniform magnetic field in the x direction at every site. So if we take a magnetic field in the x direction at every site, we know what the ground state is, because the ground state is just all the spins lined up in the x direction. That's a very easy state to prepare. You just point your spins in that direction. And then we just turn off that magnetic field, and while we turn it off, we turn on the problem Hamiltonian. And so that's the simplest example we have of a realization of this. An external transverse magnetic field. It's a quantum system. Okay, so So then you evolve with the Schrodinger equation. Now, the adiabatic theorem does tell us that as t goes, so the runtime of the algorithm is determined by the minimum gap. So what happens here is, as a function of s, is let's say there's a satisfying assignment. Let's say there is one. And we initialize the spins to line up in the x direction. And the way we normalize things, in the beginning, the energy is zero. So the ground state goes like this. And suppose it's a unique satisfying assignment. There's only one here. Then the first excited state maybe does this. And the runtime of the algorithm is determined by the minimum gap, which is the smallest energy spacing between the ground state and the first excited state as s varies from 0 to 1. So the adiabatic theorem says that if the time is much larger than 1 over g squared, then you will end up, if you evolve the system at this point, if the time is bigger than 1 over g squared, what will happen as you're evolving is you jump across. So the question for the success or failure of the adiabatic algorithm is, how big is the gap? So it becomes a question in physics of how big is the gap in this many-body system. Yeah?
This is the minimum gap or the minimum local gap?
What do you mean local?
I mean, just when you look at the local
space. No, this is for the whole energy of the system. No, the minimum gap of the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, wait, am I getting a little bit thought disordered here? I think I am. Oh yeah. So let me say one thing. So okay. So let me. Okay. So what this means is that if you look at, so now let me tell you what the consequence of this is for that scrambled cost function problem. So if you then, so now I want you to imagine that I have a Hamiltonian, which is 1 minus s. And it's the sum of the sigma xi's, let's say with a minus sign. I'm not going to put 2's in and stuff, okay? So it's just minus the sum of the sigma xi's over I. And then I have plus s, the sum on z of my cost function, h of z, zz. Can people see this over there? Or no? Ah, I'm in a little trouble. I'm sorry? You can imagine. So I have, well,
over here, so they can move it through.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll raise the board for 2 minutes. Can I do that?
How do you do that? It's an automatic thing. It also turns out to beamer, so.
Oh, you don't.
No, it's a big deal.
Okay, fine. Okay. So I'll try to write in the corner. Okay. So what if I show? So now, what this says is, suppose I'm on a hypercube. By a hypercube, I mean that my spin, you can think of every spin assignment as sitting on the corner of a hypercube. I draw a line here because this sigma x connects points on the hypercube. It flips a bit. I'm in the z basis. Okay? So this hypercube represents, the edges represent the off-diagonal terms. And I have a cost function which sits at every site. And I showed you that if I scramble the cost function, the algorithm, any algorithm must fail. That means that the adiabatic algorithm must fail. That means the gap is exponentially small. So that's why I mean I can use information theoretic results to prove things about gaps. Okay, so that's interesting to me at least. Does that make sense?
Another question. You're assuming that one minimal gap determines everything, but in many ways spectrum.
It's an inequality.
Yeah, it's just an inequality.
You have lots of.
Oh, then you'd have to, this is the smallest one, yeah. Right, so if you're bigger than this, yeah, that's right, yeah, more than one. So what this means is that if you look, and in fact, if you look at this problem with the scramble, and with we can prove for this thing. Now, this is essentially what you guys call the random energy model. It's the only difference here is that in fact, I should tell you more specifically what we do. We take the cost function h of z, first to be z1 plus z2 plus zn, a very trivial cost function that just counts the number of z's. But then we scramble it by saying it's h of pi inverse of z. So we scramble this. So if your cost function is just how many ones are in your string, that's what z1 plus z2 plus zn is. you have a binomial distribution in your energies, because there's one string with energy zero, that's all zeros. There are n strings with energy one, that's all strings zero, with one except for one one. There are n choose two strings with energy two. And you can take that, and then you can redistribute these energies. So it's not exactly what the random energy model, because I'm guaranteeing that I only have one string whose energy is zero, and I'm not picking these things. I'm picking from a fixed set, and then I'm not doing replacements. But it's incredibly close to the random energy model. Okay? And then in this case, we can prove that the ground state looks like that. We can prove that the ground state is two straight lines as a function of s. We can calculate this, and we can prove the gap is exponentially small. This is s. This is the energy divided by n in the limit as n goes to infinity. This is ground state energy divided by n, because I'm going to scale my problem, in the limit as n goes to infinity. So we can prove, we can actually prove that too.
Once you get past a half, you've actually found.
You found the winner, yeah.
Found the answer.
Yeah, in fact, this state is essentially the winner, and this state is essentially x equals zero, meaning the uniform superposition. Okay? Yeah. And there are some things that.
Why is there a kink?
Because there's an exponentially small gap. It's a first order transition, there's an exponentially small gap. Yeah, there's an excited state that comes here, right. There's an excited state that does that.
But why are you able to? So isn't there a different symmetry for the two states, so you can stay on your left-hand path and you just, why are you moving to the other branch?
Which, I'm sorry?
So there's a repulsion to this, we're not crossing.
That's correct.
In a finite system,
there's a non-zero gap, and if your time though is bigger, then 1/ the gap, so let's say your time is bigger than what, if your time is of order capital N, then you'll go slowly enough that you make the turn, but time of order capital N is what we call exponentially.
Long.
You can't do, well, if you could figure out how to, if you could design the pulse, well, first of all, you can't, because I can prove you can't, but if you can't do it in the random energy model, but if you could, in the random energy, in this model where I randomly scramble it, I proved that there's no algorithm that will work. So it doesn't matter what you're going to try, it ain't going to work. If the problem has structure, then I say, give it a try. You know, if you can identify what in the structure tells you how to design the pulse, then you would be a quantum algorithm designer. Okay. Then you could join my team. Yeah.
So do you gain anything if you restructure instead of the linear mapping, you try to make it have, you know, almost a singularity or some sort of structure right at the
end? Well, we're going to talk about different paths in a minute through Hamiltonian space. But one thing I want to say about this, so this is essentially, I would call this a picture of localization, I think. I don't know, because I'm not sure what localization is. But at least for the ground state, this is a system where the ground state changes its character dramatically from 100% delocalized in the z basis, because when I say x equals zero, I mean all the spins are lined up in the x direction. So that's relative to the z basis, the uniform superposition over all possibilities. So I would say it's a transition from 100% delocalized to localized. It also occurs at a point where s equals a half.
Of course, in the x basis, it's the other way around.
In the x basis, it's the other way around, right. So just in this basis, that way, it occurs at s equals a half.
You know exactly where it happens, so you could spend all your time there.
But that only gives you a square root speed up.
That gives you the square root.
You can get a square root of n like that,
that's
yes.
That's how you get the square root.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's how you get the square root of n. If you slow down enough,
you can, all your time
there. Then you get n to the 1/2. That you can't beat. Yeah. Now, the other thing about this problem is we can also prove, see, the reason I'm talking about this is that there is this picture of what we call perturbative crosses, which I'm going to get into in a minute, which Alshuler talks about, where he says in a localized system, there can be these levels which are coming near each other and crossing near the over here. But we can prove that there are no such levels in this problem, that the gap between this and anything else, between S of 0.9 and 1, is bigger than a constant. So there are no perturbative crosses in this model. I wouldn't call that a perturbative cross. I mean, a perturbative cross, I'm going to describe what that is. That's one of these things where you have these different competing levels coming out from this side and crossing. I'm going to talk about that more. I think what I mean by a perturbative cross is something at the end of the evolution, you have, here's the ground state, and here's another level, and maybe it goes like that. These are levels which are very different looking because they're localized, but they almost cross. I don't mean a true cross. Nothing ever actually crosses. But this phenomenon does not occur in this model. And the reason I say this is because if you read papers, sometimes people, what I really want to get at here is that if you have a random this is a completely unstructured problem. It is completely random. The gap is exponentially small. I know that's what the energy levels look like. There are no perturbative crosses. Now, if you would like to look at a random instance of satisfiability, so you go to satisfiability, which is the problem I talked about before, and you generate a random instance by picking your clauses at random. And then you say it has it looks like the random energy model, or this model, and therefore the gap is exponentially small. You just assume the answer. You may have all your condensed matter intuition, but problems with structure are not the same as random problems, even if there are elements of randomness. And the question, the really hard question is, which wins, the structure or the randomness? And so if you read papers on that randomness implies that the adiabatic algorithm has to fail, you better read it very carefully to see whether or not you just haven't assumed the answer by saying since it's random, it has to be exponentially small. But we'll get to more of that in a minute.
Questions?
Yeah.
Here you scrambled things very severely.
Yeah.
Almost as severely as you could. Is there some sense in which there's kind of a minimum amount of scrambling that needs to be done before you...
That's a great question. I that's something we would like to know the answer to, but I don't have the answer to this. I don't have an answer to that, but I would like. I guess there is an example. There is actually an example. There have been attempts to demonstrate the failure of the quantum adiabatic algorithm. I won't go through these, but this is an interesting example, which is due to Daniel Fisher, and then put in the computer science context by this guy Ben Reichhardt. And that's the problem where you have a one-dimensional chain, and you have it's an Ising model where these couplings are they're all ferromagnetic. They all want the spins to agree, but you randomly change the strength of the couplings. So some of them are one and some of them are two, and this leads to a gap which goes like 1 over constant to the root n, which is reads to an adiabatic evolution time of order c to the root n. Yeah?
Lane Fisher talks about typical gaps.
I'm sorry?
Gaps to factor from central.
Yeah, in this one, yeah. Yeah, this is typical, yeah.
So this is also a typical
gap. These gaps are... This here, you see, we can really prove things. These gaps are... typical gaps are exponentially small here. Mm-hmm. Typical, yeah. So now there is a question about whether a path change, which is this. See, suppose you take the adiabatic idea, you have a Hamiltonian, 1 minus SH beginning plus SHP, but you say, well, I don't have to take this path through Hamiltonian space. I'm going to take a new path where I add another term to the Hamiltonian, S times 1 minus S times H extra, which is just some other stuff. And then what happens is if you, then you could take different paths every time. Now, let me say one thing about, if you're looking at satisfiability, just to see, satisfiability is the problem of, is there an assignment of the bets that satisfies all the clauses. Now, if I hand you the assignment, you can instantly check if it is true. Because remember, the bets, maybe you have 1,000 bets. There are 2 to the 1,000 possibilities, but if I give you the one which I say is the winner, and you have 2,000 clauses, in a fraction of a second, your computer can verify that that 1,000 bits satisfies the 2,000 clauses. So if I have a problem for satisfiability, and I tell you my algorithm has a good chance of producing this, a small chance of producing the satisfying assignment, but not incredibly small. And then if you run it again with a different path, it also has a chance of producing the satisfying assignment. Well, as long as in a polynomial in n number of tries, you find the satisfying assignment, you've solved the problem, because you can always check when you have it to know you have it. So it's perfectly reasonable to imagine that when you run the adiabatic algorithm, for each instance, you run the algorithm with a varied path, and as long as it produces the satisfying assignment once, it works. Okay, does that make sense? But now I'm going to talk about, so I'm not going to go into the old ways to make trouble for the adiabatic. Let's talk about a new way to make trouble. So this is very related to what Alcala says. So you start with a problem Hamiltonian HP prime. Prime means I'm going to change in a minute. And it has two degenerate ground states I'm going to call Z1 and Z2. So you just imagine you have some satisfiability instance. It has two satisfying assignments, Z1 and Z2. But I want to imagine that Z1 and Z2 are far apart in Hamming weight. And what that means, far apart in Hamming weight, that means that the strings of Hamming weight just means that they differ in a lot of bits, a lot. So then, if I evolve with this Hamiltonian, in this case, I have two satisfying assignments. So my two levels are coming in like this. Now, for satisfiability, I just want to know if there's a satisfying assignment. So if I get either one, I'm perfectly happy. But now, the way we're going to attempt to screw up the adiabatic algorithm is to look, suppose the lower curve approaches Z1. Now we're going to add a single clause that penalizes Z1. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the lower curve, and we're going to say that its value at the end is no longer 0, it's 1. We're going to pull it up. But these two assignments are very different. And that will produce, so then with the curve, but that's what you then get is that. You get a very small gap. And the reason you're going to get a small gap is this curve is meant to be, you know, this is the lower one got schlepped up to this, and this is supposed to look like two things crossing. And the reason the gap is very small is because you have to go to very high orders of perturbation theory to connect these levels, because they're far apart in Hamming weight. So you need a lot of powers of this. If you work in the Z basis, then you have to go to many powers to see that. So that's the idea. And so what we did, my group, is we were thinking about this too. And we decided that we would generate these instances. So let's generate this type of instance. We call it double plants. So we looked at 3SAT, which I've already described to you. 3SAT, each clause does not like one of the 8 possible assignments of the 3 bits. And now we're gonna pick a random instance. And the way we pick a random instance is we say, let's first pick random triples. And for each random triple, let's only pick clauses which do not like either this, 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 or this. But we never pick the clause that doesn't like 3 zeros, and we never pick the clause that doesn't like 3 ones. Well, if you do that and you add enough, if you do that, no matter how many clauses you have, these two strings, all zeros and all ones, will always satisfy. Because, so we're planting a satisfying assignment. And if you add enough clauses, these will be the only winners. Because if you just keep adding clauses, you'll eliminate everything but these. But if you only add clauses from this set of 6, you never eliminate these two. So the ground state for values of S near 1 will approach either this all 0 or all 1, suppose it's all zeros, then we add a clause which penalizes 3 zeros on the first 3 bits. And this does create the situation outlined earlier. This is a way to manufacture what I said. Okay? And if you look at, for Sneer 1, we can write the Hamiltonian as H problem plus lambda V, because the problem Hamiltonian is the thing at Z, at S equals 1, and V is now just the perturbation is minus the sum of the sigma XJs. Now we're going to use low-order perturbation theory to locate the near cross. And let me show you why we can do that.
Okay.
I have 5 more minutes. Okay, well then, I'll never get anywhere. Okay. So yes, I'll just say, okay, well anyway. So you do some math, and then, which we know how to do, and you show that, what do you show? You show that the ground state is essentially, this is just lowest order perturbation theory, which says that these two ground states are coming out. Maybe I should just draw pictures. So, well, we're going to use low order perturbation theory, but now you could say usually perturbation theory is not valid at or near a cross. That's true, but you can still trust perturbation theory here. And the reason you can trust it is this. Just consider this very simple example. Well, suppose I have a system where I have this is my two energies, S and 1 minus S. They actually cross. Now, if I look at perturbation theory for the ground state, it diverges here because the ground state energy is not an analytic function. But I can still use perturbation theory to get this line and use perturbation theory to get this line and get the cross, the location of the cross. Because perturbation theory does a great job in locating the cross, it's just that it's not valid, but it's still fine to get the location of the cross. So you can use low order perturbation theory. It doesn't work near the cross, but it's good enough to actually locate the cross. And in Boris's paper, there's a very confused discussion of this. But that's okay. He still had a good idea. I'm just being honest. Okay. His paper is a good paper, but it has its ups and downs. So this is the picture of the thing near the cross, and the gap. Actually, you can show what you can show here if you do low orders of perturbation theory is that these in this situation, the location of the minimum gap is moving to 1 as n goes to infinity. That's what I'm trying to say. And using low-order perturbation theory, you can see that. And that's exactly what does not happen in a completely scrambled problem. Because we can prove that there are no small gaps in this problem. So it doesn't happen in a completely scrambled problem. It doesn't happen in the random energy model of this kind. Okay? But it still could happen in satisfiability. We don't know. Now, so the cross occurs, but because you can see this cross in low orders of perturbation theory, this cross occurs because the second term for one level is below the second term for another. But then you could say to yourself, well, look, second order perturbation theory is just from this formula. So what if I change the path? Well, if I randomize the path, then I could reverse the order of the second order perturbation theory results. And in fact, so you can take, and that's what happens if you randomize the path. You can, instead of them crossing, you can undo the cross with high probability. So we just, for the simplest thing, what we did is we took, instead of having the beginning Hamiltonian just being the sum of the sigma xj's, we allowed a coefficient in front, which was 0.5 or 1.5 with equal probability, and this gives us substantial probability of getting rid of the cross. And this is kind of interesting, because we tested this whole thing with continuous time quantum Monte Carlo, but obviously I cannot go into how we do continuous time quantum Monte Carlo. It has certain advantages. There are no Trotta errors, and it got us to use big computers and a lot of stuff. But we got up to 150 bits with this. But I don't have time, so I can't do that. So let me see where we go. Oh, yeah. Well, so what we showed is that if you have perturbative crosses, that if you randomize the Hamiltonian, you can get rid of them. So then the
question,
you can get rid of one. More than that, we can show that if you have a polynomial number of them, I misspoke. Okay, let me speak more precisely. If you have k bad guys, k other assignments which are far from the winner, which violate few clauses, in other words, k potential bad guys, then with a probability 1 over poly k, path change will fix it. So what this means is that the path change will not work if there, by this argument at least, if k is exponential in n. So if the number of bad guys is polynomial in n, then I think you can fix it. But if the number of bad guys is exponential, then you're going to have problems. Now, so I think that this issue of perturbative, so what I'm trying to get at here is this. As far as I understand it, in these problems, there are two possible kinds of ways to get small gaps. One is what I would call a localization transition. Now, we don't really know whether 2-sat or 3-sat or any of these problems have first-order phase transitions associated with localization. Nobody knows that. And I'm going to talk, I'll talk to you in 1 minute about Peter Young, because Peter Young has been doing large-scale numerical simulations of this. So let me talk about his simulations, because I think they're interesting, and then I'll stop. Now, there's the other possibility is whether these perturbative crosses, which I think can occur, when you have random instances of satisfiability. Now, it doesn't really matter whether there's, I mean, if you have a first-order phase transition earlier, you're dead. So I don't know whether you have a first-order phase transition or not. But if you don't have a first-order phase transition, but you have a lot of perturbative crosses, it could still screw up the adiabatic algorithm. So I would say we just don't know whether or not the adiabatic algorithm is in trouble because of these perturbative crosses. Now, so let me just fit, well, I'll go in for 3 more minutes because I started late, okay? Peter Young, who is a many-body physicist who works on Monte Carlo simulation, he decided that he was going to study the gap for the quantum adiabatic algorithm. He doesn't actually look at 3-sat, but he looks at a very similar problem. It's called exact cover. So he generates random instances, and he studies the gap. And so just to, if any of you have paid any attention to that work, let me kind of tell you what the summary of how it's been going. I hope I'm fairly representing what he says. So first of all, he started generating random instances. This is, again, not worst case, because he generates random instances. So, you know, if the algorithm works, if the algorithm fails on random instances, that's a pretty bad indication for how it's going to do on worst case. If it works on random instances, the computer scientists will say, well, your random instances just don't have the hard ones. So it doesn't really matter. Positive results, we always refer to any numerical results which are as not discouraging. That's our technical term. That's the only thing they can be, is not discouraging. Okay. So anyway, Peter Young, first he showed that if you generate random instances, and he worked out to like about 100 bits or so, and he found that the gaps were looked polynomial. He found the polynomial scaling in the gap. Polynomial scaling in the gap means polynomial runtime. And then he went to a higher bit number, and he changed his technique. And then he said, no, I changed my mind. I'm seeing more, the fraction of instances which have first-order phase transitions is going up. And he can see the first-order phase transition two ways. One, he looks at the gap. The other thing is he looks at a kind of an order parameter, and he sees it jump discontinuously, you know, numerically discontinuously within the, you know, changes very quickly relative to the size that he has. So then he said, you know, his more careful analysis and looking at higher bit number shows that, no, in fact, the gaps were going down exponentially. This is a one-way street. Polynomials turn into exponentials when you go to higher bit number, but exponentials never turn into polynomials. That just never happens for some reason. But anyway, so anyway, he then did the following thing. He took his bad instances, And he decided he would run the randomized algorithm on them, where he alters the beginning Hamiltonian. And he found that he did that at n, if the number of bits was n, he tossed n random paths and ran the algorithm n times. And you only have to find one path where the gap gets big. So then he looks at the maximum gap over those random instances, and that started scaling polynomially. He found that he could eliminate, with n repetitions, he could always eliminate the small gap.
Little
n repetitions. He could always eliminate the small gap. So to me, what that suggests, but I'm not sure, is that he's fixing the perturbative cross, that he's seeing perturbative crosses, and what I'm calling these perturbative crosses. Now, one reason that you could say, where is the location of his perturbative cross? But in the problem he's doing, the location of the perturbative cross is 1 minus 1 over n to the 1/8. That's just the way it worked out from the math. So it's 1 minus 1 over n to the 1/8. So if you're just up to 200 bits, you can't really see the thing moving to n s equals 1. Because the power, it's so weak, the dependence. So he doesn't see them jammed in at s equals 1, but he doesn't expect to, because the power law dependence for the problem he's doing is so weak. So he sees them scattered, but he fixes them. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether you can fix a really, you know, you can't fix this, because the scramble problem, there's a reason for it. But if you think that random instances of satisfiability are inherently inducing a first order phase transition which can never be fixed, then maybe that's true. I don't know. But he does seem to fix them, which makes me think there might be perturbative crosses he's seeing. And then you could just say, well, at higher bit number, he would just have, so, you know, he's still at low bit number, 150 or 200. He has to go to thousands, which he'll never be able to do, before he gets the real kick of evil to see the thing going bad. Hard to know. So that's basically it. Okay. Okay, yeah.
Can you make some statement that suppose in some fraction of the cases you prepare a state in a way that is null for the
You mean in the random problem?
In the random case.
Well, I can always do that, because if I identify, we know that the as n goes to infinity, I think the probability of a random instance, the probability, meaning the probability over the set of permutations, right? You have is going to one. The probability goes to one. So there's only a very tiny window. Okay, yeah. There's no. In this case, if you look at this, there are n factorial permutations. Okay, and capital N factorial permutations, and you know the fraction of them which have an exponentially small gap is going to one as n goes to infinity. Now I can't. I can tell you how fast it's going to one. No, I can't tell you how fast. I can put a bound on how fast it's going to one. Yeah.
The thing is now about what happens if you have a really realistic situation and you have environment on top of your
mind. Oh no, that's much tougher. I don't know. I think there are people who really care a lot about that and have studied it. Daniel Ladar and many people have talked about couplings and whether the adiabatic approximation works when you're coupled to a heat bath. I mean, one of the reasons that people like let me say another thing, two more things about the adiabatic algorithm. People like it for two reasons. One, first of all, you can prove that it's universal. And that means that any ordinary algorithm, for example, the Shor factoring algorithm, could be recast as an adiabatic algorithm. You could find a Hamiltonian, which if you vary slowly, which will schlep your state to the ground state you would have gotten had you executed the ordinary quantum computation. So that means any quantum, and the gap, if the problem originally took time t, the gap, the number of steps was t, the gap scales polynomially in t. So that means that quantum adiabatic algorithms are universal. And that means, for that reason, people care more about building them. The other reason people like them is because you might imagine that if you're staying in the ground state and you have a cold quantum computer, that you might be more resistant to decohering noise. I mean, imagine you could lower the temperature. If suppose the algorithm was working, meaning that you had a polynomial gap, and you could really stay at a temperature which is lower than the gap, then you might actually think that that would protect you. So that, and people, I think, believe that. So if you run the adiabatic at a cold temperature, if it's much colder than, if the temperature is much less than 1 over the gap, you have a good chance of staying in the ground state. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, there are people trying to build adiabatic quantum computers. That's one of the reasons they prefer that design to other, to gate models. It has an inherent robustness. I don't know how well proven these things are. Yeah.
So it's clear in this random energy model that all paths have small gaps.
Yes.
Is it clear that all paths also have this qualitative feature of going from something that looks very localized?
No, I don't know the answer to that, because we've never really explored this with path change. We only did it without the path change. Yeah. I don't know.
Any further questions? So let's thanks.
Okay.